No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time for the discussion of the offense and that win over the Vikings. Joining me to do that is my friend Nick Mehta. Nick, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken. Thanks so much for having me.
Always a pleasure to talk football with you, Nick. It's always a great discussion. For those of you who don't know, Nick and I go to practice a lot and hang out there sometimes, get to talk football and you know, compare observations from the side of the field and whatnot. Always a lot of fun to do that, and also to have you on this show and talk football when we get the chance.
Yeah, I took it as a source of pride the first time you came over and got my observation or my insight on something. I took that as a source of pride.
All right. I appreciate that, man. Let's talk about what happened in the game here, and particularly for the offense, and talk about the defensive show. The defensive show's out there already, and we talked about a number of the things about the positive takeaways and whatnot. I'm sure we'll hit on that because it's related to both sides of the ball. But the thing that stands out about this game is the Ravens kind of, I think, expected a very heavy blitz from Flores in this game again, because the last time he'd faced Jackson as a defensive coordinator, I believe, was the 2021 Miami game. I may be wrong. He may have faced him at some point since then, but that 2021 Miami game was one of the low points of Lamar Jackson's career in terms of he's shown a lot of cover zero blitz looks and did not really have a way to respond to it. Flores used a slightly different version of it back then. We'll talk about that a little bit. But the big thing here is he used 5.27 pass rushers per play, which is an amazing amount. I mean, you normally consider to be blitzing when you rush five by most definitions. I use a slightly different definition of it, but that's okay. Anyway, 5.27 per pass rush is an awful lot.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that was the formula, like you said, in 2021. I don't know what the number was that game. And I was coming into the game, I was very curious to see if Flores was going to stay at his normal blitz rate, which is already very high relative to the rest of the NFL, or try and do a change up and blitz less, or if he was going to dial it up. And he chose to dial it up. And I was really I was a little bit surprised, because, like you just mentioned, very predictable. It was exactly what the Ravens were expecting. And as we'll get into, they had a clear plan for it.
Yeah, they were prepared. I think Jackson had a very short time to throw in this game. So Jackson's often over 3 seconds in average time to throw, and it often can be built up by an occasional 7, 8, 9 second pocket time that he'll give you that'll get him up into the 3.2 range or something over, spread over all his throws. But 2.2 in this game, 2.2, which I believe may be the lowest of his entire career. During the entire game, he had just 2 ample time and space opportunities on 30 dropbacks, resulting in a passer sack, an unbelievable 7% ATS, which I've never seen before. At least I can never remember seeing it before. I didn't look through and check all the years to see if there'd been a case maybe for Flacco or another quarterback at some point where they've had that few.
Yeah, and that's just as much a function of the issues with the offensive line as it is with how aggressive Flores is. But again, I think the big difference in these games between this one and past games where Jackson has faced the blitz, I even felt like this was a distinct performance against the blitz than what he did against the Texans in the playoffs a couple years ago, for example, when the Texans really blitzed hard in the first half and Monken made some really good changes in the second half in that playoff game and they ran away with it. Even this, I felt like it was a completely different approach to the mid-game adjustments they made in that game. This was, like you said, all about the quick passes and really not trying to do a whole lot of the play action max protect that they've used against some blitzes to try and burn teams downfield. It was, in many ways, it was kind of an Occam's razor approach. The simplest approach to winning this football game is going to be the best one. Get the ball out quickly and take care of it as well.
Yeah, this is, I think there were differences from the first Flores game. The first Flores game included a lot of 5-2 blitzes, what I'll call them. And what I mean by that is they showed 7 along the line of scrimmage and 8 sometimes. But they would drop 2 guys from the middle and create an overload on both edges. Now, the 2 guys in the middle happen to include Adam Butler on a huge number of plays. A nose tackle dropped 18 times of coverage in those plays. I think there's probably people out there who know that number by heart because I've said it so many times on the show, but they're dropping a lot of 2 men from the middle. The nature of blitzes in general and of cover 0 blitzes is you're always one man short in terms of protection. So it's not a matter of, well, let's just bring one extra eligible receiver inside to block because the quarterback can't block anybody. You know, you're always one man short. If you bring all 10 in and they have all 11 rushing, you know, that's all you got. So the, Flores can always get one more than you. And what he did in 2021 was get one more than you had on each side of the formation, which was very effective. He didn't do that as much here. There were some coverage drops, but I thought it was more of a balanced across the line approach to getting advantages rather than a overload at particular points.
Yes. And I think his first few years in Minnesota, I remember there was a statistic about him leading the league in drop 8 and cover 0 coverages because of his willingness to mix it up between showing a 7-man pressure and having 4 guys drop off the line of scrimmage and some really dramatic things that I felt like were much less present in this game. I felt like the elements of deception in their blitz packages was minimal, less than what I'd seen from the Vikings defense as I was kind of preparing for this game. I think, again, the Ravens, the giving Lamar Jackson the control at the line of scrimmage and letting him look around and diagnose really, really showed up in this game as he was making all the adjustments. In a lot of instances, you could see him making the adjustments and then watch it play out during the play.
Yeah, they did it. They did an effective job, I thought, when they did come with the more extreme numbers of using a guy on the edge, particularly the strong side of the field. Van Ginkle seemed to be in that position to try and disrupt any swing or screen pass that was going to that side. So they were trying to get on what they thought would be the most likely passing vectors and influence that. And, you know, all the times they dropped Adam Butler in the 2021 game for Miami, well, Brian Flores had a secret weapon in the middle in this game. It was Javon Hargrave, was just unblockable by the left guard and center for the Ravens. Linderbaum and Voorhees just had no luck with him at all.
Yeah, you mentioned the the preparedness of the Vikings defense for the screens that are going to be a common answer to the blitz. There was one play early on where I think it was the play action screen to Derrick Henry where it looked like Jonathan Allen was just all over that play. So I think on the other end, while the Ravens came very prepared for what the Vikings would throw at them, the Vikings came pretty prepared for what some of the Ravens' early answers. And I think that was part of what happened in the first half was that the Vikings were ready for some of those screens, those design plays, and just shut them down pretty quickly. It wasn't until the Ravens really snapped into a quick pass underneath, finding the holes in the zones, that they were able to move the ball a little bit more consistently through the air.
Yeah. And even then, honestly, the passing game was minimal. The pressure was so high that the expectations are lower on passes. But it's a very tough sledding environment. It's not Lamar Jackson's natural way to throw, to try and beat defenses with on-schedule throws. So if there's any kind of route running involved to hit a player exactly when he breaks out of a route, that's not really what Lamar does. And so it's something that, probably something he could still add to his game at a higher level. I'm not saying he can't do it ever. I'm just saying he's never been the back shoulder guy, for example, that Joe Flacco was on the sideline with Derek Mason. And he's never really been the great slant thrower we have seen at other times from quarterbacks like, say, Joe Burrow to when he has a weapon like Chase or other Bengals receivers. They've had Higgins. Tough environment for the offense. I thought both from what Flores showed them and also in terms of the sound in the place, and ended up being a tough environment for both offenses with all those false starts. I'm sure you were amused by that. I did a whole breakdown of the false starts in the defensive episode, but I'll just give you a chance to get your take on that.
I mean, I was giggling. I was chortling. I mean, it was really funny. They couldn't figure it out. There was one that got called on JJ McCarthy at one point. I didn't see exactly what happened there, but I just, the embarrassment of having so many false starts in your own stadium is tough. I was kind of glad that JJ McCarthy didn't go to the press and talk about, oh, the visiting fans made it hard for us, because when Tua admitted that after the Dolphins game, I was like, you couldn't get that out of me under torture. I would not have admitted that. So I kind of turned it back to you, and I'm wondering, Ken, we were both at the Miami game. That was a huge presence from Ravens fans. It felt like M&T Bank South. What was the feeling from Ravens fans in Minnesota? You know, was it really any sense of the crowd having an effect, or could the Vikings just not get it together?
No, it wasn't noise from the Ravens fan. It was very quiet when it was there. We were talking with other folks at the airport about this, because I saw that the kind of the discussion of it had come out because of the post-game interview with O'Connell. And O'Connell was asking his players, what are they doing at the line of scrimmage to mess you up, kind of thing. And he's trying to see if the Ravens were making line calls, or they were trying to simulate the snap in some way that was messing up their players. It wasn't any one thing. And he was the first to say there was no evidence that the Ravens were doing something to cause these false starts, I think he might have been more specific with relation to the snap calls, because you're not allowed to do that. And that's right. Something that the Ravens have occasionally been called for before. And I've made the point on this show that Peter Boulware was called for that multiple times in his career. I kind of wonder whether he's just trash talking with the tackle opposite him as part of his, you know, pre-snap patter and whatnot, that he was kind of making him forget the snap count or trying to do that. But he was called for a delay of game penalty on multiple times. The Ravens, it was actually kind of fortunate for them, and I don't think the league will take any action against the Ravens. I do think they made moves towards the line of scrimmage that caused false starts, and I think it's a potential for a rules change or some other, you know, specificity being done for 2026. But they were fully within the rules in terms of what they did, as far as I can see. They did have a couple of different occurrences where multiple players, Van Noy and Hamilton, and I think one was Van Noy and Wiggins on the outside to the right, both moved kind of at the same time pre-snap, and that caused one of the false starts by O'Neal. But it was also a bunch of other stuff. You mentioned the McCarthy thing. McCarthy just lifted his right foot off the ground. You can't do that. And all the Ravens immediately noticed it, and they were right on it and pointing at him in the way they'll do. Jefferson had a problem when Wiggins made a quick move opposite him on one play. And then they had one out of the tight end on the other side. It was another case of a quick move. The center moved the football on a ball, and that was a case of Hamilton moving up right over center. In multiple ways, that's distracting to the center there, because he's got to make a new line call that involves Hamilton. Hamilton is a hulking presence and obviously had given them a lot of trouble in the pass rush. But I thought it was just fascinating, very funny to watch. And the fans around us were just smacking their head play after play as it would happen.
Yeah, but we could hear the boos on the broadcast. And it's like they had a false start and the stadium is booing really loudly. And I was thinking, oh my God, they better not get another false start as a result of all this booing. It's one of those things where, like, we've seen the Ravens have these problems. It's something that, you know, a lot of people have really railed about their pre-snap penalties. I know that people have looked statistically, they're not like crazy out of bounds. You know, they're in the wrong half of the league, but nothing crazy. They've never done that. They're not putting up 8 false starts at home. I think people were hoping that there would be a 9th so that we could say we're 9 false starts for JJ McCarthy, but alas.
He's 9, his alternate ego, yeah. All right. They ran the ball reasonably effective given the crowding the line of scrimmage, I thought. And this is how they didn't run for their normal yards per carry numbers, and they didn't really leverage the value of the read option or the misdirection in the same way. What I thought they did do a pretty good job of is play point of attack, running the football with a heavy use of Patrick Ricard in this game and heavier personnel with the tight ends and use of a fullback to get as good blocking as they could. to try and create some seams. And it is a risk of, you know, showing everybody across the line of scrimmage that if you get punctured at one place there, you may have a lot of people lost in the wash trying to get back to the play.
And I think one element of their running game, you know, you mentioned Ricard. I felt like he had a much more noticeable impact in this game. But, you know, getting Jackson's legs involved early and then kind of backing off of it, using Jackson's leg was a really big part of their approach against the Texans blitz plan a couple years ago, like I mentioned. And it was just something that they gave it a couple tries early on, but didn't really go back to it, I felt like, for much of the game. And that's something that, you know, I really think they should think about using his legs more in the red zone. I've really wondered why they've gone away from that so much. It's been so effective. And I think the other thing to consider with running the ball in this game is, you know, as we've talked about, they're crowded in the line of scrimmage. They're looking to blitz already. And that attacking mentality makes it harder to run some of the read option plays in the back that can get you, keep you in the backfield, even for a fraction of a second longer. Yeah. And so, you know, again, it's a smart approach from Flores that forced the Ravens to do exactly what they did in this game and needed those plays from the defense to do well.
Yeah, I agree with all that in terms of what you said. And obviously they took away the read option in a lot of ways with the crowding of the line of scrimmage. But you also, in theory, you might make your point of attack football more effective if you can get a field. Now, if they get a lot of penetration, nothing will really save that, because penetration and first contact in the backfield is very detrimental to a run game. People talk about it being specific to Henry. It's not. It's any running back. It's hit in the backfield. It's a very bad thing. But they did run the ball very well, not only from a point of attack fashion, but also when they were closing out the game. So they got 5 rushing first downs in the final 17 minutes when they had a good solid lead in the game. You know, they were up by 9 points or more for most of that time. And they really did a good job of putting away the game with those last 5 rushing first downs.
Yeah, I think it was really the tail end of the game that the offense sputtered. They did a really good job, you know, most of the third quarter, most of the fourth quarter. And then it was those last few drives. I think they had they have 2 3 and outs towards the end, if I remember correctly. They had at least one, and maybe another short drive as well. You know, that was the only thing, you know, from this offense that I was a little bit disappointed by at the end of the game. Was they had opportunities to run the clock all the way out. They had opportunities to pick up 1 or 2 first downs and you know, effectively close out the game. And it's the kind of thing that this team used to do really well. And it's one of the reasons why they've struggled as front runners, I think, in the last year and a half or, you know, 2 years or so, is because they've lost that ability to just chew up 6 minutes of the clock, get the ball back with 6 minutes, and then chew it all up and the game is over. It just doesn't seem like they're doing that, or they have the ability to do that as much. I think part of that is because Monken wants to get a little more aggressive and sees points as more valuable than chewing up time, which is, you know, it totally makes sense. But I did feel like in this game towards the end, there were a couple of instances where they could have taken up a lot more time than they did.
Okay, I'm not sure I would accuse Monken of being a guy who goes after points as opposed to expected win probability. He better be, because you lose your job pretty quickly if you don't go after expected wins and play closeout running football. But a lot of the times, I mean, the decision you're making in the second half of an NFL game usually puts expected points and expected wins at odds. All right, so you're winning. You trade expected points for expected wins if you've got the lead by running the football and killing clock. And you trade turnovers and probably expected points on a net basis for expected for the ability to come back if you're behind. So that's why I really hate expected points models. I think they're really weak relative to expected win models. The problem is expected win models aren't particularly transparent. And that's a problem we have as a, you know, as an analytics community, that we need to have those be transparent and look at the source. But everybody's, you know, is for obvious reasons, very protective if they have a good expected wins model.
Yeah, and I remember the specific sequence I was talking about. It was the 3 and out There was a three and out in the fourth quarter, where Jackson got sacked on the second play and threw an incompletion on the third. So you know, they lost the yardage, and then on third down, incompletion. So you don't get to kill more time. And then it was the throwing. It was throwing the ball on that third and four on their last drive that I also had an issue with. I wanted them to run the ball there and force. I think it was force. No, the Vikings already used their third timeout. So I that was another one where I was like, I didn't understand why they were passing the ball there.
Right. So a first down would have sealed the game. A running play would have meant they got the ball back with about a minute and 10 or a minute and 15 to play after a punt. But there was going to be a full run off of the clock that would have occurred after the third and fourth play. So there was some groaning about that from Ravens fans in the stadium. And then they got the ball back very deep, and it didn't really matter because Keon Martin took care of running out the clock for the Ravens at that point with a couple of really nice inbounds tackles.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. Also, I guess there's not really a point to talk about this. Maybe we can mention Jordan Stout, another great really point. Excellent game. I know we talked about his extension potential in training camp, and he's definitely trending towards one at this point.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think they probably want to do that. They love Stout as a holder, I know, so I think that they probably want to go there. Ravens reestablished themselves as divisional favorites by a very solid margin now. So your dollar returned on each of the four teams. If you bet Baltimore, your dollar returns $1.40 now to win the AFC North. That's the best price among about 20 online books via Odds Checker. Returns $3.70 on the Steelers. Returns $21 on the Bengals and $301 on the Browns. So you get 301 on the Browns or 20-1 on the Bengals if you want that. I guess bringing the Bengals up here, we gotta ask. We've heard news that Joe Burrow may begin practicing this week. I don't think it's happened yet, but I guess it would happen tomorrow on Wednesday. Are you concerned about him being back for the Thanksgiving Day, or do you think that's all a bunch of smoke and mirrors that Burrow is trying to put up a tough front that he might be back?
I think the Ravens either face Joe Flacco or they face a Joe Burrow that's significantly below 100%. One of the main ways he's beat the Ravens is his ability to extend plays within the pocket. It's an underrated characteristic of his. He's like surprisingly nimble in the pocket and has a good feel for avoiding like rushers coming low around the edge and diving at his feet. That's going to be hard for him to do if he's playing in that game. Based on his injury and all the reports about it, it seems very unlikely that he is back to a fully nimble Joe Burrow by that game. So if he's playing, I have to imagine he'll be limited. And that will give the Ravens at least a better shot of slowing down that offense. And if Flacco is playing, obviously then Burrow isn't playing, and that's a whole different story. I think the Bengals also have to, you know, at some point, hopefully, you know, I respect Joe Burrow. He's a good quarterback. I'm tired of seeing him get killed. So I think the Bengals also have to think about, if they lose their next two games, I don't know if it's worth bringing back Burrow behind that offensive line that is, you know, continue to get him killed.
Well, they have only one game, and the Ravens and Bengals only have one game prior to the Thanksgiving game. So it may be their last chance, period, even if they're 3-7, right? They don't play them.
I thought the Bengals had this. They have the Steelers, the Patriots, and then the Ravens.
I thought it was on the 23rd. So the next game, am I wrong about that? I mean,
they play the Steelers next Sunday. They play the Patriots the Sunday after, and the following Thursday is Thanksgiving against the Ravens.
Okay, my mistake. Okay, well then, Burrow returning on that day would be a big deal, obviously, and they could make the decision based on the outcome of these next two. So if they lose one out of two, they'd be 4-7. It would be the last refuge of a scoundrel to try and get Joe Burrow into that game to see if they could renew their season. By the way, if
they're being realistic, if you look at the stretch of their next five games, Steelers, Bengals, or Steelers, Patriots, Ravens, Bills, Ravens, it's hard for me to look at that and think that the Bengals can get through that and make the playoffs.
Right. I'm with you. Okay, we had an awful day for the offensive line in this game. They missed a lot of run blocks, which was unfortunate, in addition to some spotty pass blocking. Now, the pass blocking that occurred and a lot of the pressure that occurred, it wasn't all on the offensive line. Some of it was, but it was a lot. It was on extra man pressures and unblocked guys who were in there at forcing Lamar to get rid of the ball quickly, which wasn't even necessarily a pressure every time. It was a case of he had to get rid of it quickly. Very difficult day, though, in terms of run blocking and in terms of not making blocks. Took a long time to score this game, in part because you almost do pass blocking as a unit sometimes, because if the quarterback gets all day, even if some of the blocks don't look great, it generally is a scoring block for each of the linemen. The individuality of run blocks makes it a lot more difficult to go through. And oftentimes you need to go between broadcast and all 22. You can't just do it with one or the other. So you have, you're checking your multiple resources at once. And that's a problem, but it was an awful day for the offensive line. We'll get to that in the second part of the show.
Yeah. And this has been a theme of the season. Jackson finding a way to succeed in spite of the offensive line. Ken, I'm sure you can provide more detail on this. I felt like when I was rewatching that the issues in pass protection were more a matter of individual matchups and losing an encounter than it was, miscommunication or lack of preparedness for the blitzes that were coming. I felt like that was generally the case. There were definitely some instances when a free rusher came in that shouldn't have. But I did feel like in terms of, again, that preparedness element, the communication at the line, Jackson steering things. Again, this is a arguably more a Jackson thing than anyone else. But that all was well coordinated and well executed in terms of everyone knowing what they were supposed to be doing. Now, everyone doing what they were supposed to be doing, completely different story. But I did feel that was pretty present. And that was a reason why he was able to get the ball out on time so consistently, is because at a minimum, everyone was starting and trying to do the right thing, even if they didn't complete it. It prevented any like instant pressures, which is a risk with these blitz packages.
Well, I mean, you get free runners and the ball's got to come out very quickly. And if the man isn't open, then you got a problem. And sometimes they were so good at covering the side exits, as I'll call it, any kind of screen or swing going to the strong side in particular, that became a real problem. So yeah, I would agree with that, if a team is adept at doing both of those things, you got a big problem. You're probably going to have a pressure that at least has to move Jackson. And it might've been a case where the Ravens would have done better to do what I thought worked better late in the game, which is move the pocket entirely of their schematically, like not have a question of, they want the pocket to be a certain place. They're going to block it as well as they can. And Jackson's got to react to any shortage by throwing it out. But they've done a good job with a rolling pocket where the line knows a rolling pocket is coming, and they block for that in the past. And they tried that, I think, once or twice in the second half, but they didn't make it a regular part of the game plan.
Yeah, again, not something you, I would expect. Like I said earlier, Occam's razor, simple approach, and they stuck with it.
All right, we got it. We'll go a little quicker on some stuff here. They dug themselves a big hole in that first drive on offense, and then subsequently giving up a scripted touchdown drive that did not look good. The combination of a three and out followed by a touchdown drive on the road, you're already then going to give up the halftime potential double possession. Didn't end up happening that way, of course, because the Ravens held for a field goal at the end of the first half. But the that was a big lead at that point for Minnesota to be up 7-0 after that first drive. And I did think it was particularly bad that they'd done it with a set of scripted plays where they knew what Flores was going to throw at them, but they also probably should have known in a lot of ways what was going to come at them from the Vikings offense. Mm-hmm.
And that start to the beginning, that start to the game, like you said, it gave the feeling of, almost like the last two games, the balloon has been popped and we're back to the Ravens team that was struggling to start the year. This is something that I was kind of mystified in the game. The Vikings stopped running the ball. That game was very close, mm-hmm. and they really stopped running the ball. And that was the thing that alarmed me the most on the opening drive, was how many chunk runs they were ripping off. And, it was something throughout the game that really contrasted between the two things, was first down. The yep. Vikings were constantly picking up solid gains on first down, and the Ravens were just not. And that was a huge difference between the two offenses.
Yeah, that was a big difference. And one of the points that was made, a number of their runs came either on first down or they got a first down, but a lot of them were 10-plus yard runs on first down. And so then you come in with a fresh first down and you want to stack another run and you get a false start. And they had a lot of first and 15s in the game that kind of reduced their ability to stay up with the sticks and maintain a running game. You can run on first and 15. It's just not as you know, the real advantageous idea that it would be if you're first and 10 and you're being really effective running the ball. All right, let's move on a little bit. The Ravens, you know, their comeback was very slow. They didn't take the lead until the third quarter, largely because of their crappy red zone success. They were 2 for 5 for the game, but 0 for 3 before they converted their last two. On the other side of the ball, on the defensive side of the ball, they were winning the high leverage plays on third and fourth down. After the first three attempts, the Vikings did not convert another third down except by penalty. So they didn't have a converted play after their first three attempts. And then they went 2 for 5 on fourth down, and those were some real good field position swings for the Ravens as well.
Yes, the field position was a big part of the battle all day. And it was a reason why, despite you know the what the offense was dealing with in terms of the blitz and how much that takes them out of what they want to be doing, the way the Ravens won the field position battle is part of what made the offensive output kind of disappointing. The amount of times that they were set up and had opportunities to score or to you know to get in the end zone, and they just didn't and really take control of the game much earlier. This is something that I felt like this game in some ways was the kind of game that you can win in the regular season, but is not a game you're going to win. You're not going to win this way in the playoffs.
Yeah, I really don't like it when people say that, but whatever, we'll leave it. It's true. You face better teams. They turn the ball over less, yada, yada. But I whenever I hear that, it's like one of those things that gets my bullshit meter registering in the red. Whenever
it's not what beats a playoff team. Is that a better representation
it's less likely to work against better opponents who have better takeaway ratios. And I mean, or turn the ball over less effectively. I would say it like that. I see you're like already coloring it. And this is general advice. I'm not doing this to you, Nick, you know that, but I think other people out there avoid putting the playoff tag on things. Whenever you want to try and boost a narrative of yours, I think it's a really bad idea. And people who are analyzers of the sport, you know, understand the Ravens' playoff woes and what's happened, and they also understand, you know, what really impacts playoff football and what doesn't, and they've lived through a lot of the experiences the Ravens have having great turnover margins in the playoff as well. So it's not, you know. There's some truth to the fact that you're generally going to face better teams in the playoffs. Nobody's going to disagree with that. But to try and tag everything to boost your own narrative with that specific tag, it immediately sends my bullshit detection meter into the red.
I mean, I also think in a more general sense, like not taking advantage of opportunities is going to kill, but it's going to kill you in any game. I get where you're coming from.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
No one plans for hair loss. But through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, Visit Hims.com/Hail Mary. That's Hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. Hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary. Based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress. For a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
Should have meant more. You're not going to win playing that, you know, you're not going to win performing that way against a better team.
All right. I mean, you know, you look to 2 years ago when the Ravens beat the living snot out of everybody, every good team they faced. In fact, 1 year ago, they did that to every good team they faced, and particularly during the regular season, which it shouldn't really matter. You look, they went in on Christmas Day night, because it was Christmas night, right, against San Francisco, and had four takeaways against Purdy, who was the MVP candidate. And you look at what they did against Tua when the Dolphins were still a marginalized or on the margin of the playoff discussion at that point. I mean, they've had plenty of success taking the ball away from really good football teams, and they could do it again. This team right now, they look like they know how to play takeaway football again. And that's what's good about this. They didn't have real positive game script the entire game here. They didn't even have really positive game script when they got their turnovers. So a lot of it, and they've had positive game script during this three-game stretch where that was part of how they got their turnovers. But a lot of it is just shots on goal. They, you know, they punched the ball three times on two different kickoffs in terms of getting fumbles there. They in the previous game where they had two fumble recoveries on Buchanan tackles with strips for the second man, that was great. They had great loose bracket play in this last game, and they got one of two interceptions on loose bracket play. Gilman had a drop, but Stark certainly had a great loose bracket interception. I mean, I love the way that this defense is assimilating to getting to high turnover football, because I think they're doing the right things in neutral game scripts. And then you have all the advantage game scripts that will come up naturally as you tend to beat the crap out of these teams.
Yeah. I guess my point is just the teams that I just look at the teams they've faced. I understand Ben Johnson is, you know, the big mind, but Caleb's not there yet. McCarthy's not there yet. Tua is gone. I don't want to say like the defense isn't getting better. It's obviously getting better. It's doing a lot of really good things. But I do look at who they played the last 3 weeks versus who they played the first five games or six games and wonder, you know, what unit we're going to get when they play another team that's as good an offense as the Lions, for example.
I'm gonna flip the other side of this coin, and I'll say this. The Vikings, the week before they played this game, just beat the Detroit Lions 27-24 with basically the same team. Okay. And if you go back to the Bears, who they beat three weeks ago, the Bears have won six in a row outside of the Ravens game. And they've been one of the best teams in football. They're at the top of a lot of teams' power rankings or a lot of power rankings and whatnot. So I think they're a team to be taken seriously as a playoff contender at this point. And Miami is not a serious playoff contender, but they won the week before and they beat the snot out of Atlanta, and they won the week after and beat the snot out of Buffalo. So, you know, the Ravens 28-6 win is not a minor win. It was a Thursday night road game. They beat the team by 22 points. It's a legitimate win. I mean, it's yes, Tua made a couple mistakes in this game. He had one game script interception, and they made some other mistakes too. I'm not saying that it's you would want to have. You would want to base your view of a team entirely on how badly they beat the Miami Dolphins, but it wasn't a bad win at all.
No. It wasn't a bad win. These weren't bad performances. I guess I'm saying in the Bears game, in the Dolphins game, in the Vikings game, I saw the other team make just a lot of mistakes. I felt this way in the Rams game. That was closer.
Yeah, that's true.
The score was closer than the final result. The Ravens have done a much better job of taking advantage of these mistakes relative to, I feel like, the beginning of the season, where the teams they played did not make many mistakes, And when they did, the Ravens did not punish them for it. They only did that against the Browns. But in every other game, you know, if the other team made a mistake, a number of times the Ravens would make their own mistake right back. I think the big difference in these games, what I want to see them sustain, is this ability to take advantage of your special teams and your defense giving you good field position. That's why it was frustrating early on in the game, right? You talked about those three drives where they got in the red zone, didn't score. I think two of those times were produced, if not all, I think one of those times they drove the ball there themselves, I think. The other two were produced mainly by a turnover or special teams play. And it was them not taking advantage of those things early that had me worried. They took advantage of it later on and cleaned it up and closed out the game. But I guess they need to take advantage of every mistake their opponents make, not just some of them.
Okay, well, fair enough. Let's let it go at that point. I think I would have a slightly different view, but that's okay. We talked about power of attack. Good balance for the Ravens in this game. If you know, they've been accused of not being able to maintain balance in a lot of games, particularly in playoff games, but they were 36 and 30 rush and pass when the other team is crowding the line of scrimmage and daring Lamar to beat him through the air, basically. That's fairly amazing that they can get that kind of a run-pass balance in a game like this. And I thought, you know, they found reasonably good ways to pierce that, you know, 7-across and 8-across looks that the Vikings were showing them.
You know, again, Ricard was a big part of that, but they left opportunities on the field because a good amount of times just the big guys in the middle they just couldn't get the push. They just couldn't do the job. They were getting moved around too easily, or they just weren't moving the Vikings defensive line. It's, you know, we could talk that issue to death, I'm sure. But that was the thing I noticed this game, where Ricard looked like he had a better game than he did in Miami. He looked a little rough, a little rusty a couple of times. Mm-hmm. I felt like in this game, he looked much, much better. And you know, that was one of the primary reasons that the Vikings weren't getting in the backfield. There weren't a lot of plays where they got in the backfield and took down Henry. And I think a lot of that was just Ricard being able to bolster at the point of attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. And we saw 37 snaps from Ricard, which was nice, because he hasn't been utilized to that degree in any game. The Ravens, by contrast, they did not try and throw over the top. And if you think about the old Joe Walsh strategies, a lot of those are to get the ball out within 2 seconds and hit your receiver between 41 and 42 yards downfield. And they could have tried some of that, but that would be on schedule throwing, and they'd be depending on the receiver to out-muscle the defender for the ball. That's a throw you make, by the way, to DeAndre Hopkins. He won't necessarily beat the receiver, but it'll be either a pass interference call or potentially a reception where he out-muscles the guy, or Hopkins will play defense, maybe pick up an offensive pass interference call, but he'll play defense and he won't allow the interception. So, but they didn't try with that. It's not a great option to throw to Flowers that way necessarily. I like it. I like plays where Flowers makes a cut, because I don't think anybody can stay with Zay Flowers right now when he cuts. It is a throw you could try with Bateman as well. But anyway, another possibility. Let's talk one issue we didn't talk about is the hip drop tackle on Bateman near the goal line. What was your view of that? Watching the game at home, what did you feel about it?
It's kind of like asking, what is my general feeling about officiating? Because there are so many things that you see and are pretty obvious. The hip drop tackle is like, yes, that was a hip drop tackle. It's super clear. And I don't really understand why they don't call it in games. There doesn't really seem to be a very strong logic to not calling it in games when it's obvious. And when it's obvious, right? Like that, it's like that play hit all the hallmarks of it. It was easy enough for anyone to see in real time. So it's always a little bit perplexing why they're taking this approach with not flagging it for the most part and only doing fines after the fact. I just don't think that's a very effective approach in managing this issue at all.
You probably remember at camp, I guess it was before the 24 season, when it had come up in 23 with Andrews, right? 23, Andrews had got hip dropped upon. Mm-hmm. Before the 24 season, they came in and they showed us all this video of it happening across the league and how, you know, the player safety was number one and they were going to find a way to officiate this. And they had an official, might have been Cleet Blakeman, came in to talk to us that time about the hip drop tackle. And it was a lot of talk. That's what it was. And I found it additionally offensive that two of the videos we saw were shown were of Ravens executing hip drop tackles when, you know, we just lost Andrews for a substantial portion of the season because of a hip drop tackle. And, you know, like, really, you're going to come here and show us this?
Yeah, and Dobbins went down to a really, really clear one on Thursday, too, and they didn't call it. So, you know, Bateman understandably frustrated with that. He's dealing with an ankle sprain and is probably out for a game or two at least. I guess didn't go chase down the officials after this one and draw a fine for that like he did in Miami. But it's frustrating. Again, I'm the kind of guy where if I saw the Ravens make a hip drop tackle and not get flagged, I would be annoyed by that too, because it's the kind of like player safety thing that the NFL really needs to be getting right. And they're just right. Not. And the fact that hip drop tackle has entered our lexicon, everyone knows what it is, but a referee cannot identify it, is right. Perplexing.
Yeah. So that did have all the elements, no doubt about it. And they, you know, the twist and drop and all that. Ravens now 7-0 in turnover margins over that three-game win streak. We talked a little bit about it, but I think the good thing the offense contributed to in this game in that regard was that they did put the ball in danger a couple of times. They had some fumbles on the sideline, mostly out of bounds. I think, I'm not sure if Likely fumbled out of bounds, but Mitchell definitely fumbled out of bounds. And Lamar had a couple of tip balls, and a couple of tip balls were sent up in the air in the dangerous volleyball territory where you might end up with interception. Fortunately, neither of them was.
Yeah, he batted one down. Flowers had a fumble that bounced right back into his hand.
Right back to him.
I think, you know, obviously I differentiate, you know, the Flowers fumble versus Mitchell's going out of bounds or even the tip balls. The Flowers one is just one that, like, that's got to stop happening on a very basic level. The tip balls, that's going to happen. The Ravens that were in the area whenever they could did a good job of, it looked like, you know, Jackson not going down. It looked like other players were kind of like boxing out a couple times. They know what to do there. You know, the fumbles going out of bounds is, you know, not ideal, but, you know, a lot of times that's on a case where the ball is on the side of the sidelines. The player has it on the correct side so that if it does get hit, it goes out of bounds. So can't complain about that at least. Take care of the ball. It's an astounding way to win football games.
Yeah, and this was only the second game of the year the Ravens had 60-plus snaps. They did actually win the snap count battle 66-61. But for a team that is just so built on sustaining drives and what the Ravens have been the entire Lamar Jackson era, to only have 2 60-snap games in this far into the season is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's something John Harbaugh pointed out very, very early this season. He mentioned it a number of times, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, the average fan doesn't think about quite as much. But once you do, it kind of dominates your head because you think about all the ramifications of not having a lot of snaps, what that means for every other part of the game, whether it's on offense, yardage, defense, field position, all those things are coming into play, and it's all kind of a root problem in your team, in your offense. And, you know, like you say, especially for this kind of a team, right. they need to be controlling games, and you know, they need to be the team that's putting other teams in the position that they have been put in this season. That was probably a very unhelpful way of saying that. In other words, they need to be the aggressors, the way that other teams have put them in these very tough time of possession and play deficits. That's how this team used to play, and that's how they've, you know, won games and dominated games in the past. And that's definitely something that is just missing this year.
Well, hopefully this stretch of games will give them some opportunity to have some nice two-score leads that people can not complain about them blowing. They're in a, you know, you really got to be able to sit on a team with a 2 or 3 score lead. And the Ravens in their history have been fantastic at doing it, generally speaking. But, you know, they've gone through a stretch also with Lamar that the only games they seem to lose are by one score. And whenever you lose a game by one score in the NFL, it's a great thing about football. And that's what we love it. And that's why it's so dramatic. It's why it dominates everything about ratings in terms of sports, is the fact that all these one score games can come down to one play. And they usually can come down to 5 different or 10 different one plays in a single game. And, you know, it's just drives you up the wall that they do this, but Lamar has always kept them in games and been around, and they didn't lose games by 2 scores. So when they lose games by 1 score, they hurt like hell.
And I think you noted this earlier, recently, especially the defense, they have been making those plays. They have been the ones to make the one play that has won them a couple of their recent games, which was, again, not the case to start the season. It was always the other team making that one play that was the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they've certainly had problems with that. Let's talk about Lamar a little bit. I talked already about the number of pass rushers per play. I'm going to go through real quickly. Flores never sent three on the rush. He sent four. They dropped back 30 times. It resulted in a passer sack. There are a couple other scrambles in there too, but 30 times resulting in a passer sack. Eight times he rushed four. Eight times out of 30. 68 net yards, 8.5 yards per play. If Flores knew the statistics during the game, he'd realize he'd be doing Lamar Jackson a favor to rush only four. Right. When he rushed five, 13 times, 62 yards, 4.8 yards per play. One of their sacks, their only sack, came on a five-man rush. Six-man rush, three plays, 0 yards. All three plays incomplete. Seven-man rush, five plays. Usually this is the point where we get to zero or one, but seven-man rush, five plays, 39 yards, 7.8 yards per play, and an eight-man rush one time incomplete. So it gives you an idea, 5.27 rushers per play, just an outrageous number. But I think Flores probably went into this game and said, it worked before. Let's try it again. If it doesn't work, we'll adjust and we'll call off the dogs. But we're going to try it. And then, you know, it worked fairly well. The Ravens weren't catching up in the game. You know, it was 7-3, 10-3, 10-6, 10-9, finally 12-10. Then they you know, screw up the kickoff and it becomes 19-10. It took a long time for the Ravens to catch up in this ball game.
And credit to Flores for committing to the bit. And embracing this, it's fascinating to watch what is kind of become an experiment in Minnesota. It's been very interesting to watch his defense play out. I am a little bit curious what would have happened if the Ravens did have some more explosive responses to his early blitzes and really put him on his back foot. Because I do wonder if, like you said, if he would have adjusted and backed down, or if he would have just kept the pressure up and lived and died with it. I wonder if he would have been willing to do that. Obviously, it's good for the Ravens that they, or I guess not good for the Ravens that they didn't find out. It would have been ideal for them to try and force him off his game plan. But like I said, I think the one thing I was surprised by was that there weren't a lot of plays where he like dropped a lot of people off the line of scrimmage. Right. And I felt like a lot of those five-man rushes were a product of overloading one side, and all you had to do was win one matchup. And that's not too hard to do against this line.
All right. We'll talk about ample time and space, ball out, quick and pressure. Those are the three categories I divided into. Two ample time and space opportunities all game for Lamar Jackson. That's a 3-second pocket, room to step into his throw, only 7% of the time, which is, I'd say the normal is maybe 28, 29% now. He completed both of those for 39 yards. So 19.5 yards per ample time and space opportunity. No problem there. 11 times he threw the ball quickly. That's 37% of the time. He went 9-for-11 on those throws, 72 yards, 6.5 yards per play. It's a little better than expectation, but it's pretty much right on the money for what you'd expect, 6 yards a throw. 17 times he was pressured. 57% of the total dropbacks he was pressured on. He completed 6 out of 16 of those for just 58 net yards, 3.5 yards per play, which actually is right about average, and one sack. So Lamar also did run the Ravens out of one pressure, which is not included in these 30 totals, but a fairly absurdly bad opportunity set for Lamar Jackson.
I think this was also part of the Flores game plan, was not giving him opportunities or lanes to run himself out of any pressure. And that was, you know, again, it takes away one of the biggest parts of his game. You're taking this giant ball of energy that can't be contained, and you're somehow shoving it into this little box. And as Jackson showed, he can do it. I don't think anyone really enjoyed it. I don't think he enjoyed it. I don't think fans enjoyed watching it. But they did what they had to do. And I think that I'm curious to see if other teams, as we go on in the season, if any other teams are going to take such an aggressive approach. Having seen this and having said, okay, well, we kind of put Lamar in a box, we really contain that offense for the most part. And if our offense doesn't give them the ball, if our offense and special teams doesn't screw up so many times, if the Ravens offense puts up that performance, we feel like we might be able to beat them. I wonder if teams are going to look at this and think, that they'd rather live and die by this rather than letting Jackson dictate the terms.
Yeah, I guess I would think so. There's a time during the game that I was really surprised at what occurred, but it was in the first half on the Ravens' last, not their last possession, because they had a quick streaky 30-second drive in there, but the drive that ended at 1:14 with Loop's 28-yard field goal, they came up on 4th and 2 at that point. Now, I think from a mathematical standpoint, that would normally be a go-for-it situation if you all things being equal kind of situation. Jackson, it looked like to me, and obviously he has communication in his helmets, he's already heard what the coach wants to do. It looked like he stormed off the field, almost not wanting to run that play. He's obviously pissed off about the situations. It's hard for me to really delve into what his motivations are because they're not always clear with Lamar, but he was obviously very unhappy with the constant pressure he was facing. Almost seemed like he was not unhappy that they were kicking a field goal and he didn't have to run that additional play there.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Lamar is obviously the type who's always wanted to stay out on fourth down. But I don't believe, you know, this was not an instance where I wanted Harbaugh to be more aggressive, or I was lamenting his lack of aggressiveness, which is something I've done a number of times in the last year of him suddenly becoming quite conservative on fourth downs. I was curious to see if he was going to go for this one, partially because they had taken so many, they'd taken the three field goals already, or the two field goals already. Mm-hmm. I didn't see Lamar storm off the field. My instinct is usually that he wanted to go for it. I guess it would be surprising if he wanted to get off the field on a 4th and 2 is the only thing I have to say, is that would be a little odd.
That's why it seemed odd to me. And I agree with you completely about Lamar typically wants to go for it, but Lamar was just, he was after the 3rd and 2 had failed, he was heading directly to the sidelines. He was pissed off, maybe pissed off that the play hadn't happened, but I can only describe what I saw and say that he did not really seem to be excited about running a 4th and 2 play.
Yeah, I mean, he may, you know, it's also possible he may have already known that if they didn't get the third down, yes, they definitely weren't going to go for it. He storms off.
I mean, that's going to be 50 shades of gray, right? Because if they're running the football on third down, which I believe what they did, I think they did that and not pass it. Let me just see for a second. It was Derrick Henry running left for no gain. So if they gotten 1 yard, maybe they do it again. Maybe they go to an Andrews at quarterback kind of tush pushy formation. Could have done a lot of different things, but with no gain, just kind of left the field. It was weird. I guess if there's no record of that on the broadcast, there certainly wouldn't be any record on the all 22, because you don't see between plays there to really get a view of it.
So, yeah, probably not.
All right, real quick, couple of things about Lamar's performance. He was about 26 yards better than his opportunity set, which is really incredible given how unimpressive his offensive numbers look. But he should have thrown for about 143 yards with the opportunity set he had, and he threw for 169. I think what was even better is he didn't have any turnovers out of that. So he's about a yard better, 0.9 yards better than his expectation per play. But also to have no turnovers is outstanding for that kind of pressure applied.
Yes, part of the plan, I think, was also not putting the ball in danger. We talked about the tip passes, but other than that, knowing that as part of this plan where you're going to go quickly, a lot of quick passes, part of the reason that that's not going to work if you turn the ball over, obviously, but not putting a lot of risky passes, trying to punish the blitz with riskier downfield passes, seem to be pretty intentional.
Okay, so I'm looking at week 10 here, and there's not a whole lot of quarterbacks that are listed in terms of, there's probably only about 15 quarterbacks that are listed, and I know there were more games than that. There was a minimum of 15 passing attempts, so somebody like Justin Fields might be not on this list. But Lamar Jackson was dead last in time to throw in the entire NFL. He's usually in the top three. Okay, he's usually one of the players is over 3 seconds. He almost always is near the top of the quarterbacks for the week. This week, he was at 2.2 seconds to throw. The next lowest was Baker Mayfield at 2.62 seconds to throw. So 0.4 of a second less than other quarterbacks. Very different game from Lamar.
Get the ball out of the hands of the best player on the opposing team, right? I mean, it's It's why this was such a fascinating game planning game in terms of how each team was going to come in.
All right, let's move on to some other scheme elements. The Ravens running game, they did give most of the snap division to Henry, who had 47 snaps on the field. Hill had 19, Mitchell had 5, and Ali was inactive, which I thought was a good move in the right direction. Now, they seem to have committed to Mitchell over Ali. Is that your take on this as well?
Yeah, I think part of it is just the numbers game worked out this week where they didn't have, you know, certain guys inactive due to injuries as well. I think Ali is probably of their healthy scratches. I think Ali is probably the first one they activate and swap out for an injury. But I also think it's good that they recognize that what he brings on special teams is simply not as valuable as what Keaton Mitchell brings on offense. I think the Ravens are still not quite understanding how valuable Keaton Mitchell is on offense.
Right. And they only had him in there for 5 snaps, which is unfortunate. They did run the pony once. You know, you mentioned who's the first guy back. The guy that I thought they really could have used in this game is Tez Walker. You get the good special teams out of him and you get a deep threat. If you want to throw the 42-yard pass that's out in 1.9 seconds or whatever it is, then he's a perfect candidate for that as well. Not just he can outrun the defense, not just, be even and play great defense like a Hopkins can.
That's why, to me, it seems like they just decided pretty intentionally not to go down that route. One other thing I wanted to say about Mitchell is, you have noted, you know, he got the ball in 4 of his 5 snaps, and the Ravens have talked about not wanting to be too predictable, bringing Mitchell in and then making it obvious he's going to get the ball. But then you just have to integrate him into the offense so that he's not this gadget guy that the defense keys on when he comes in.
And you still have another guy to give it to. You know, it's Lamar, or it's Henry, or it's him out of a flanker position, you know, crossing with jet motion. If he has that kind of gravitational impact, use it. Even use it as a decoy.
Right. But I'm saying, like, I guess my issue is what the team was saying, what their explanation was for not using Mitchell and not wanting to be obvious, but then on his five snaps, they give him the ball 4 times. Which I don't mind. I just want him to play more. I just want him to play more.
Yeah, we had 10 snaps last week, but that is the original Harbaugh comments about everybody knows he's getting the ball if he's in there. That also sets me into the red in this BS detection meter as well. It's such a lousy reason. Occasionally, too, you get somebody who goes into John Belushi mode from the Blues Brothers, and it could be Todd Monken, it could be any assistant coach, and it could even be Harbaugh, though I hear it less often with him, like rattling off 5 crappy reasons for something. But there's a scene in The Blues Brothers, the original movie, where Belushi is confronted by Carrie Fisher in the sewer. And I know you're a film guy, so you remember the scene exactly. And he says, "Hey, honey, I was busy. I had to make a phone call." And he comes up with these 11 different reasons why he couldn't be there. And he jilted her at the altar or something. I don't remember exactly what the situation was. And then he drops her into sewage and runs off with his brother at the end of the thing. And I'm just thinking, you know, you hate to be in a position, or you hate to be faced with somebody who makes an argument and the 9th argument they make is actually a good one for it after they give you 8 crappy ones. And I've been in that situation in business before a fair amount. And it's very frustrating.
In this case, there wasn't even a 9th good argument. It was... it never made sense, and I guess then you see him do so well and be productive, and it's still on such a limited snap count that you're still frustrated by it, and especially on days where, you know, the offense does lack some rhythm. Obviously, something that was an issue when Lamar wasn't under center, but even on a day where you're struggling to punish the defense for how aggressive they are, having a guy like Mitchell and his speed is a very clear counter that they just decided not to use as they could have. Ken, you're muted.
Thank you. 2.14 heavies per play, Ravens season high. We talked about that a little bit before. They didn't really get a lot of production from the tight end. They did get a fair number of targets, 12 targets, but for only 54 yards. So you're not looking to get 4.5 yards per target really from anybody. They did get a touchdown to Andrews, which was one of the big plays that helped secure the game, though. So what they did use their eligible receivers for a lot in this game was set and chip blocks. So they used 21 set blocks in this game and 0.93 eligible receivers blocking per play. So per drop back that results in a pass or sack is how I define it. But that actually, I thought, in with respect to the number of pass rushers per play, was actually kind of conservative. They didn't waste a lot of their assets keeping him into block. And actually, it's a fool's errand to do so, I think.
Right, because the Vikings brought 5.27 pass rushers per play, and so on average, right, they would have more coming than the Ravens would be keeping into block. I think it's also notable, I don't remember what the numbers were last year, but the amount of help that Roger Rosengarten was receiving in some of those games, it was a lot. This is a completely reasonable amount of help to give, you know, your blockers in this situation. But I remember those numbers being really high. Some of the help he got, I think, against Watt in particular last year being very, very high. This, though, it's again, it's what you expect. It's a function of, I think it's also a function of them being very prepared and Lamar being very prepared at the line of scrimmage to organize and keep guys in where he needed them.
That the help for Rosengarten, there's been a fairly dramatic shift in that this year. And I want to talk about that in the offensive line when we get to it in part two. But thank you, Nick, for joining us for part one here. Why don't you tell folks where they can talk football with you online if they want to, or read your work?
Yeah, you can find my work at Baltimore Beatdown. I've taken over as managing editor there this season. It's been a great experience so far. And you can find me on X at Nick, N-I-K, Noseball.
All right. Other folks out there, thanks so much for listening. As always, if you can, please try and promote the show in one of three ways. You can like and subscribe on YouTube. Always appreciate that. You can you have a 5-star 50-word review. That's always much appreciated. If you want to use hashtag Film Study Mailbag, that's kind of a backdoor way to support the show. And we'll mention you, of course, and we'll talk over what you're passionate about Baltimore Ravens football. Nick, thanks again for joining me.
Thanks, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.